Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, October 11th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Forum Brings Debate on Local Issues. MISD School Board Candidates Address Intercessions Worth, by Stuart Doreen. Intercession was a topic during last week's League of Women Voters School Board Candidate Forum. There were candidates for, some against, and one who noted, there isn't the data available to know if the weeks made available to provide intervention to struggling students were effective. Elections for three of the seven Midland ISD school board seats will take place November 8th. Early voting will start October 24th. Brandon Hodges, a candidate for the District 5 seat, almost ended the debate before it started, noting, I haven't seen any data come from Midland ISD that says whether intercession helped. It was a point that other candidates couldn't debate. Last year was the first at Midland ISD that weeks in the fall and spring were allotted for intercession. Hodges did say that he thought the district would have been better off investing dollars in reading specialists, but was willing to let the data help make up his mind. Hodges' opponent in District 5, generally North and Northeast Midland, is current Representative John Trischetti III. He said he is for any opportunity for continued remediation. Trischetti also said the data he needed to see was the Texas Education Agency's B grade. He also said intercession provided opportunities for enrichment, like SAT prep. In District 3, current Representative Tommy Bishop is running for re-election. He said he supported the intercession calendar, but noted there is not enough data to know if it was a reason for the district's academic gains. His opponent in the Southwest Midland District, Reagan Hinojos, said continuing intercession provides an opportunity for the district to follow through on a concept. He said teachers have told him that they wanted to stop seeing programs done for a year and then processes change. He said he supported the intercession calendar. In District 6, which includes parts of Western and Northwest Midland, Sarah Burleson said she believes intercession provides a better option than after school when students and teachers are tired. Carrie McNeil said she was not a big fan of the intercession schedule that she said was disruptive to low-income families, those needing a mental health break, and families that need time together. This article is entitled, Council Candidates Discuss Downtown, Cities Demographics, by Stuart Doreen. The League of Women Voters Forum for Midland City Council candidates included conversations about downtown and appealing to a younger demographic. Two of the council's seven seats are on the November 8th ballot. Early voting begins October 24th. About downtown, former Mayor Jerry Morales told the audience at Midland College that city leaders needed to show a vision for projects like the Bush Convention Center and Centennial Park, a pair of public-private partnerships dreamed up during his administration. He believed the entertainment district being talked about can go a long way for more changes. Councilwoman Lori Blong said downtown has become a great asset for the city and a place that people can congregate after dark. She also pointed out the success of local investors and projects like the Micro Market to bring more activity downtown. District 4 candidate Amy Stretcher Burks said it is nice to take her children downtown, but that she wants to see improvements to District 4, generally West Midland. She said District 4 is growing, and its constituents need roads in place and safety concerns addressed. Her opponent, Jim Garrity, said downtown is a hub for any city, and that he didn't see why Midland couldn't be like communities like the Metroplex community of Roanoke, where urban living has taken off. About Midland's growth of younger residents. Much has been stated about the average age in Midland dropping to 32 and younger. The population increase, driven by increased oil field activity of the last two decades, has brought more 20-somethings and 30-somethings to Midland. Burks talked about doing things that make families want to stay in Midland. Garrity said younger people want green spaces and parks, and there isn't much to offer in West Midland. Blong said younger people need to be invited to the table and shown places where they can become involved. She pointed to the UTPB's Entrepreneurial Challenge as a way to turn great ideas into real-life concepts like the Tall City Brewery. Morales said that during his terms as mayor, the city leaders worked to improve parks like Dennis the Menace and both water parks. He said there was a priority put on green space with housing developments and the creation of young professionals associations. This article is entitled "Contract Can't Keep ISD Leader in Midland" by Stuart Doreen. One of the complaints most often heard after Superintendent Angelica Ramsey left Midland ISD for Fort Worth ISD was that she was under contract. As it turned out, the contract for a superintendent isn't any different than it is for a football coach. If another job comes calling, he or she can leave with little problem. Midland ISD officials stated language could be put into a contract with the superintendent that includes provisions that are intended to deter a superintendent from leaving prior to the end of any contract term. However, any superintendent contract must be mutually agreeable to both the candidate and the district, according to Ilana Ladd, Public Information Officer for Midland ISD. Board President Brian Murray said he believes it is unlikely that language would be put into the next superintendent's contract that would prevent Midland ISD's next leader to take another superintendent's position within a period of time. Murray said his preference is to put in incentives for a superintendent to stay. Ramsey stayed in Midland around 18 months. "We definitely will be thinking through all the options to retain the next superintendent," Murray wrote. "The problem with required language is the possibility you get a superintendent that doesn't perform, because that almost guarantees a 3-year payout if you move to separate." The Midland ISD board did exactly that with former Superintendent Orlando Riddick in 2020. The language in that contract meant Midland ISD could approve a $70,000 separation agreement with Riddick instead of being locked into a potential payout based on Riddick's $275,000 annual salary. As it turned out, Ramsey doesn't appear to have any specific language in her contract with Fort Worth ISD that locks her into staying in Fort Worth for a set period of time. The Fort Worth Report stated in its report about Ramsey's contract that she is, quote, "expected to stay with the district for at least the next 3 years, according to her contract," unquote. The language in the contract, however, appeared consistent with Ramsey's final contract at Midland ISD. A copy of Ramsey's contract with Midland ISD stated that the district would pay her $310,000 for 3 years through July 31, 2025, provide her with a district cell phone for business use, and allow for $1,000 monthly travel allowance in lieu of mileage expense reimbursement, gasoline, insurance, and other charges associated with travel within the district. Ramsey will receive a base salary of $335,000 a year through August 31, 2025, along with technology and car allowances at Fort Worth ISD. This article is called MC Profile. It is entitled "Military Veteran Enjoys Building New Career in HVAC" by Rebecca Bell, Midland College. Eric Phillips said that getting laid off from his oil field job during the spring of 2020 at the beginning of the COVID pandemic was probably the best thing that could have happened to him. "I graduated from Stanton High School in 2007 and went straight into the Marine Corps," Phillips explained. "While in the Marines, I worked in supply and logistics for 4 years at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. When I was discharged from the Marines in 2012, I came back to West Texas and got a job in the oil and gas industry, where I was employed for 8 years, first for Key Energy and then for Great Plains Drilling. Phillips said that when he got laid off, he was ready for a change and tired of the cyclical employment trend of the energy industry. "My cousin is an electrician," he said. "He makes a decent living and isn't at the mercy of the oil field." So I did some research to see what opportunities there were along those same lines. That's when I discovered the air conditioning, heating, and refrigeration technology program at Midland College. Phillips started taking courses in the program in January 2021, and within 1 year, he had obtained a Level 1 certificate. The very next month, January 2022, Bosworth Company hired Phillips as a residential HVAC technician in training. He continues to take classes at Midland College in the evenings, working toward an Associate of Applied Science degree, which he is on track to obtain in December. "My mother passed away this past March," he said. "She was my motivation for obtaining a degree and pursuing an HVAC career." Bosworth is a wonderful employer. They have a great reputation and was the company that I always called when I had air conditioning or heating problems. So after I obtained my certificate last year, I decided to submit my application to Bosworth and was immediately hired. I don't think they would have granted me an interview had I not gotten a certificate from Midland College. Even though I've had to sacrifice my evenings to attend classes, in the end it will be worth it. I really enjoy the work that I'm doing. The demand for air conditioning and heating technicians is climbing. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the need for HVAC technicians is expected to rise 15% through the year 2026, which represents 48,800 new job openings. In addition, the increased complexity of both home and commercial air conditioning and heating systems will create more job opportunities for service. Environmental concerns and new government regulations will require replacement of older units no longer in compliance. "The technology is always changing," Phillips said. "That's one thing I like about HVAC work. I like to learn new technology so that I can stay ahead of the curve." Fortunately, when I complete my degree at Midland College, Bosworth continues to offer professional development opportunities to help their technicians stay current with the latest technological advancements. Phillips will continue to be a technician in training for Bosworth until March, at which time he will be promoted to technician. He currently works and goes on calls with another technician, Levi Garcia, who also graduated from Midland College's HVAC program. "There are several of us at Bosworth who were trained at Midland College," Phillips said. Jeroy Roberts, Midland College's lead faculty member for the HVAC program, is a great instructor. He really knows the industry and technology. I learned a lot from him that helped me with my job at Bosworth. Phillips lives in Midland and has two children, a son Diesel, who is 10 and a fifth grader at Fannin Elementary School, and a daughter Ava, who is 13 and in the eighth grade at Goddard Junior High School. In his spare time, he enjoys watching movies with his children and riding and working on motorcycles. Rebecca Bell is the Executive Director of Institutional Advancement at Midland College. This article is entitled, "Check Out These Adoptable Dogs Available in Midland," by Mercedes Cordero. Want to adopt? There are plenty of dogs and cats waiting for their forever home. Every week, volunteer photographer Tasha Sport photographs some of the animals available for adoption. The adoption fee is $62 and includes microchip, rabies vaccination, license, tag, and halter. In honor of October being Pit Bull Awareness Month, all Pit Bull and Pit Bull mixes will have a reduced adoption fee of $20. On a monthly basis, the shelter takes care of approximately 350 to 400 pets. Here's more information on how you can adopt. To adopt one of these pets, please call the shelter to set up an appointment at 432-685-6000. 7420. Hours of operation, Monday closed, Tuesday to Friday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Saturday, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., 1200 North Fairgrounds Road. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, Oilfield Services Sector Continues to Add Jobs, by Kyra Buckley, Houston Chronicle. Companies that provide equipment, labor, and technology for oil and gas drilling continue to add employees. But employment in the oilfield services sector remains well below pre-pandemic levels. In September, employment in oilfield services and equipment ticked up nationwide to 640,767, according to preliminary federal data analyzed by the Energy Workforce and Technology Council. The industry trade group estimates that after August adjustments, the sector added 2,566 jobs in the U.S. last month. Overall, oilfield services employment sits about 65,000 jobs below February 2020 numbers, the month before the pandemic brought drilling to a near standstill. Texas is home to nearly half of those jobs. In September, the council estimated Texas oilfield services employment at 312,246, a 3,970 dip from August's preliminary numbers, but still well above where Texas started the year at around 287,000. Both September and August data are subject to adjustments. As the energy services sector continues to rebuild the workforce from pandemic losses, the September increases are encouraging in the face of lower job increases across the country, said Leslie Beyer, CEO of the Energy Workforce and Technology Council, in a statement. Overall, the U.S., the economy is still growing, although the pace of hiring has slowed slightly in recent months, as the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates in the hope of reducing inflation. The news comes as oilfield services companies are set to report earnings for the three-month period ended September 30th later this month. Houston-based Baker Hughes is scheduled to release its third-quarter results on October 19th, followed closely by Schlumberger, Halliburton, and Weatherford. So far this year, the oil and gas industry has reported record-breaking profits as multiple factors put pressure on oil prices. Recovering demand from the pandemic was already lifting oil and gas prices. Then Russia's invasion of Ukraine and retaliatory sanctions pushed prices higher, while further tightening global oil supply. More recently, moves by OPEC Plus to limit production quotas has sent the price of West Texas Intermediate, the U.S. benchmark for crude oil, back above $90 per barrel. This article is entitled, Oil Price Momentum Stalls as Recession Fears Mount, by Elena Peng and Julia Fanzeres, Bloomberg. Oil markets slipped as concerns of slowing demand again came to the fore, adding resistance to a rally spurred by OPEC Plus's output cut. West Texas Intermediate settled at $91 a barrel, ending a five-day run of gains in which futures climbed 17%. A tighter supply outlook following last week's OPEC Plus meeting gave crude its biggest weekly gain since March. But fears the U.S. Federal Reserve will go on boosting rates to quell inflation caused equity markets to decline and the dollar to strengthen, making commodities that are priced in the currency less appealing. Crude is in a corrective phase from last week's $9 per barrel rally, wrote Dennis Kistler, senior vice president at Bock Financial Securities, in a note to clients. Overall, global economic activity is expected to slow. The U.S. Fed has signaled a potential fourth 75 basis points hike in November. A U.S. jobs report last week further rekindled concerns about continuing interest rate hikes. Oil markets continue to be buffeted by concerns about the global economy and the cuts announced by the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies. Traders are closely watching for demand signals as growth is likely to suffer from central banks' monetary policy. OPEC Plus's output cuts, which drew rebuke from the U.S., could turn out to be much smaller in reality. But a slew of leading banks said it could still send prices higher this year. Key oil market gauges have shown signs of increased bullishness since the OPEC Plus decision last week. The spread between the nearest two December contracts for Brent, a much-watched marker of the market's health, rallied to the strongest level since June. At the same time, options markets have seen a flurry of bullish call trades. On Friday, Brent options volumes were the highest since March, as traders placed a series of wagers on rising prices.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, October 11th, 2022, Education section. Midland College hosts showcase for MISD students. 8th grade Midland ISD students will soon be choosing high school endorsements. In order to assist them in making these important decisions, Midland College is hosting a special program showcase specifically targeted for 7th and 8th grade students. Students and their parents are invited to stop by the Midland College Advanced Technology Center on Tuesday to attend one of three sessions, 5:30, 6:15, or 7 p.m. After an introduction, participants will be able to visit with teachers and other program personnel to learn about education, training, and career opportunities. MC partners with MISD for many special programs that allow high school students to get hands-on training and college credit while they are in high school, Courtney Fairchild said. This event will allow students to learn more about these exciting opportunities. The Midland College Advanced Technology Center is located at 3200 West Cuthbert in Midland. For more information, visit midland.edu/showcase or contact the Dual Credit Service Center at 681-6341. South Elementary teacher seeks devices for Chromebooks. Mr. Manette, a fifth-grade teacher at South School, is seeking additional equipment for students to make technology use easier during classes. There is $359 still needed to fully fund the project, which expires February 5th. All donations are currently being matched by the Chuck Lorre Family Foundation, a Donors Choose partner. The project will reach 65 students from 3rd to 5th grade. The students use their Chromebooks in class regularly and would benefit from some extra equipment to make their lives easier, Manette posted. Materials being asked for are verbatim corded notebook, optical mouse, USB, read, quantity, 25, cost $6.90 each, or Maxwell HP 100 headphone, quantity 25, cost $3.94 each.
This is the opinion page. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, MISD's Decision to Expand Idea Travis Was the Right One, by Stuart Doreen, staff columnist. Thank you to Midland ISD's board for approving the expansion of the district's in-district charter at the former Travis Elementary into a K-12th grade campus. You made the right decision. Expansion is the right thing for hundreds of students on Midland's south and east sides. The Travis campus is an in-district charter run by IDEA Public Schools. So far, it has been a home run, as the former worst campus in Midland County recently fell just 2 points from an A grade. Officials at Travis and Midland ISD had to settle for a 38-point improvement. At the meeting, when Travis's expansion was approved, board member Rick Davis said Travis's 7th graders were the second highest performing 7th graders in reading and the high performing in math in all of Midland ISD. This decision should be guided by the academic success of IDEA Travis for our MISD students, Davis said that night. And what a success story it is. Which is kind of the point. Over the past 5 years, when Midland residents have been bombarded with election governance terms like Lone Star Governance and System of Great Schools, And they have dug in deep about the supposed fight over neighborhood schools and out-of-town operators. Many lost sight that our schools were in a bad place. They forgot that we had to jump through special hoops to avoid TEA takeovers of certain campuses. They certainly didn't appreciate that steps were taken to try something different to help education leaders not experienced in the rebuild Midland would need for its public schools that ranked near the bottom of the 200 largest in the state. Idea Travis isn't what was wrong with education in Midland. It is a reason for optimism. But don't take my word for it. Ask 600 families on the south and east sides of Midland that are on the waiting list to get their students into the school. Some will say the campus in southeast Midland is not a neighborhood school. I'd like to see one that better supports minority students and their families. Unlike other campuses in that area of town, their student body isn't there because of a test or application that showed they can hold up to the academic rigor. They are there because families, whether right or wrong, have lost faith in today's education system. Idea Travis gave them hope, like other programs happening at the time. This was the right opportunity for their child. It was based on a model that worked elsewhere in regions like the Rio Grande Valley, and it worked here. There really wasn't a reason to hold back the expansion. Nothing credible, anyway. Don't like an in-district charter? Show those hundreds of families an option for their child in that part of town. There isn't one. That might not always be the case, but it is now. Expanding the school allows the model that shows it can work to fulfill its mission, to show more students that graduation will take place and college will be a possibility. Improved academic outcomes is what we should be striving for. And that is what the expansion of Idea Travis promises. A majority of the Midland ISD board agrees. Thank you to those four who said the expansion of Idea Travis makes sense for families in South and East Midland. Thank you for backing up the talk of wanting to improve academic outcomes with appropriate action. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, October 11th. Lori Farquhar Grizzard. Lori Farquhar Grizzard, 60, passed away Friday, October 7th, 2022, in Midland. A visitation will be held at Golf Course Road Church of Christ in Midland on Tuesday, October 11th, from 6 to 8 p.m. A celebration of life service for Lori will be held Wednesday, October 12th, at 1 p.m., also at Golf Course Road Church of Christ. A dessert and visitation reception will follow immediately after the service in the Church Fellowship Hall. Lori Farquhar Grizzard was born April 14, 1962, in Lubbock, to Ron and Loretta Farquhar. Lori is survived by her children, Kimberly and Brandon Blake of Trophy Club, Krisha and Carson Grizzard of Midland, and Lauren Grizzard of Abilene. Lori also leaves behind four grandchildren. Survivors also include Ron Farquhar, Mark and Janice Farquhar, and Christy and Jeff Payne. Lori was preceded in death by her husband, Russell Grizzard, her father-in-law, Clint Grizzard, and her mother, Loretta Farquhar. In lieu of flowers, the family would like donations made to Reflection Ministries. Death Notices. Bob W. Dutton. Bob W. Dutton, 75, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, October 8th, surrounded by his family. Celebration of Life will be held on Friday, October 14th, at 2 p.m. at First United Methodist Church in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelsh.com.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, October 11th. Trustees to discuss bond. The Ector County ISD Board of Trustees will discuss the failed bond election results and potential next steps during a workshop set for 6 p.m. today in the first floor boardroom of the Administration Building, 802 North Sam Houston Avenue, The proposed $398,255,000 bond was resoundingly rejected by voters in May. There was controversy over where to put a new high school, the amount of the bond, and there was a social media campaign against it, and also signs around town telling people to vote no. Board President Steve Brown said he'd like to have a discussion of board members to find out where the board members are, what they think, what they're hearing from the community, and then determine whether or not they want to explore calling another bond issue. Brown added that it takes a lot of preparation to call a bond. With that being said, we need to probably update our demographic information. What we have is about 18 to 24 months old or older. Then we would want to put together a bond committee, and all of that takes time, and determine when would we want to go for another bond. Would it be November, a year from now, or next May? The bottom line is we're going to have to do something with our overcrowded conditions, Brown said. He said the bond committee would mostly be made up of new people. It would be a whole new committee. You want to invite a good cross-section of the community. The other committee is no longer in action, so it would be a totally new committee. There may be some that would choose to come back on, but by and large, it would be a new committee. And you've got to update the facilities report. It's not going to be as intense as before because we have a good idea of where we are. There would be, I'm sure, some minor updates and tweaks to the facilities report. The demographic study, I think, is critical to the work, and if the predictions before are holding true, then certainly it would support the need for a bond issue to pass, Brown said. It seems before the May election that efforts to get the word out started too late. I just think, for whatever reason, the public, the citizens, were not ready for that bond issue. Certainly we have to own part of that. If we didn't get the information out in time, then there was a lot of information put out there that wasn't correct by other interest groups. You have to put that into the equation. The bottom line is we've got to get the best information out there, the most accurate information that we can, and to be honest, we need to get people to vote, Brown said. Certainly, we'd want them to vote for the bond issue, but my goodness gracious, we need people just to vote, to take an active part in our community and our state and our nation, he added. The voter turnout for that last bond was not good at all. So I think that's an emphasis that we need to place in regardless of your position, take part in the process. Whether it's a bond issue, a city or a county election, or state amendments, or state offices, or federal offices, our community needs to be more active and more robust in the way they participate in the voting process, Brown said. Board member Delma Abalos said she thinks the concerns are that they need to go back into the community and talk to people more in depth. Instead of them coming to us, we need to reach out to them and find out what it is that they would like to see us do. The main thing I've heard is that there's no doubt that a bond is needed, that we need more schools, so now that we need to come to a consensus on is where the community suggests those schools be placed, if we can get a bond passed, Abalos said. It has seemed that people want new or revamped facilities, but they don't want to pay for them. However, Abalos said that's not what she hears. What I'm hearing is that they weren't happy with where we wanted to put the schools. The biggest concern was that people didn't vote. There's probably different reasons why they didn't vote, she said. She said maybe people didn't like the options, or they didn't vote because they didn't feel informed enough. Abalos noted that the bond committee went everywhere, trying to inform people. But it's also going to be the board's job to get out into the community and ask people what they would like. But now they're going to have to be more specific. Abalos added that she would like to get parents involved and for us to take our time going out into the community to different schools and talking to parents and finding out what they would like to see us propose on a bond. Abalos said there are going to be naysayers, and frankly, I think it's going to happen again. Not that we can't win. I think we can win a bond, but we're just going to have to be more strategic in going out and getting the support of the parents in the schools, because I do believe that it wasn't parents saying no. Parents didn't vote. And so what we're going to have to do is make sure we get their support before we even ask for a bond, so that we can find out what it is that they would like for us to ask for. Board member Donna Smith said she has been hearing that even naysayers and those who were terribly opposed to the May 7th bond agreed that the needs are still there. I think the strategy that we'll need to talk about is how do we do things differently this time so we can get more people to vote with what they already think is true, Smith said. She added that she knows the tax increase is always a reason for people to vote against a bond, but people were perhaps also influenced by the conversation about where the new high school would go. I'm hearing that a lot of people felt like we need to pay more attention to the south and the west parts of the county, and that by putting the high school in the parcel of land that the district already owns in the northeast corner, we're just continuing to privilege the east side at the expense of the west side, Smith said. But would people really vote for a bond if it were put on the west side or south side? That's kind of the issue. When all of this started, before we made any sort of decision, I was arguing the point that we needed to locate in the south and the west, and the argument against that was, number one, we already own the land in the northeast corner, so that using land that we already owned was more responsible stewardship of the public's money. And there was the fact that historically, people in the northeast sections of the county vote more than people in the south and west parts of the county, she said. Another argument against the bond was that the district's academic performance has been so poor. But to the district's credit, those teachers and administrators have really put into place structures so that we're doing better academically than we've done in years, Smith said. If we're doing that well with subpar facilities, it's only logical to assume that if the community will invest in us more, we can continue that arc and be even better, she said. I think the question that we need to consider is what's different now and what can we do differently now so that we can get a different outcome. Of course, the better academic performance, that's a big one. But I keep wondering, can we do a better job in making sure that all of our employees are registered to vote? We can't tell anybody how to vote, nor would I want to tell anybody how to vote. But we are the biggest educational entity in the county, and it's our responsibility to model civic behavior for these children. If our employees are not even registered to vote and exercising that right, I don't think we're being very good models for the kids, and kids will copy what we do. So I feel like it's really important that we stress that everybody at least register to vote, and to the extent possible, encourage them to vote, not telling them how to vote, but go out and vote, Smith said. She hopes they can figure out a way to get students more involved, engaged, and knowledgeable about district needs. Smith recently attended a conference at the end of September, and another idea she ran across was to figure out how to bring parents into the schools right before the election to tour the hallways of Odessa and Permian high schools when classes are changing. The parents could stand in safe pods and watch what it looks like for a student to get from point A to point B. That's got to be powerful because those schools are so crowded. I'm not advocating that we do any of these little strategies. I just hope that we talk about how creative ways to get the same information out there, and I feel like we need to identify the people who are influencers in the failure of the last bond and make sure that we're talking to them, make sure that we're listening to them, make sure that they feel like their voices are being heard and understood, and ask them for help, Smith added. She added that people in the south and west side of Ector County are angry because they feel their needs are not being represented well enough, and they need to help the district figure out how to meet their needs and how they feel like they're being taken seriously and listened to. I can't speak for anybody but me, but I'm really interested. I want to know, what did we do wrong last time that turned you off so seriously? Why didn't you get more involved in the planning process? What are we doing in those planning processes that make you disengage? I also feel like we need new strategies for social media. Social media is a big deal. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram, but I don't participate that much. But if we had someone designated to watch those feeds and then send out an email, okay, here's what's being said, could you go on, and there's some strategies for responding. Shoot, I would do that, Smith said. She also added if they were hitting all the social media they should be hitting. I think there's an app called Nextdoor that I'm not really on, but I think I remember hearing that there was a lot of negative buzz on that platform that might have given us trouble. I just want us to think out of the box. These needs are not going away, and I know that there's a huge anti-tax sentiment. I get it, I understand, but there's not another way for us to meet these needs. We can't build a school out of our fund balance. It has to be financed through a bond, Smith said. She added that she has heard that ECISD is not trusted and that it's not transparent enough. It's been really hard for me to figure out what people mean when they say that. So that's a question to ask and then to listen and try to figure out what's the issue. Because from my perspective, we do seem transparent, but I need to understand why people think we're not, and let's think out of the box and figure out how to meet that need, Smith said. A group called A Better Way Forward has continued meeting for people who didn't want the bond. Its next meeting is at 6 p.m. Wednesday at Little Ranch Party Place, 15837 U.S. Highway 385. The May Bond had two separate propositions. Proposition A, $215 million. $255,000, which would include maintenance and life cycle repairs, replacement for school district buildings, $130,255,000. Various projects for electrical, mechanical, plumbing, fire, and life safety, and others at schools and auxiliary buildings. Construction of a new career and technical education center, $70 million. Classroom and lab space for programs like welding, construction, health science, automation, and process technology, HVAC, plumbing, and others, estimated at 150,000 square feet. This would have included furniture, fixtures, and equipment. Classroom technology upgrades, $15 million. Classroom and or campus audiovisual and multimedia refresh or additions. Proposition B, $183 million for a new comprehensive high school. This would have included construction of a new high school designed for 2,500 to 2,800 student capacity, estimated at 400,000 square feet. It would have included furniture, fixtures, and equipment. District leaders anticipated the bond would create a tax rate increase of 15 cents and for a home with a taxable value of $100,000 would equate to a tax increase of approximately $12 per month. The website said there would be no tax increase on residents' homesteads for taxpayers 65 years or older, as state law dictates that the tax rate and the amount paid on a residence are frozen when that person turns 65 years old, applies for the exemption, and is approved by the Ector County Appraisal District. ECISD gives local taxpayers a 20% homestead exemption, which is the maximum allowed by law. The meeting also includes a report and discussion of beginning of the year assessment data, presentation of curriculum and instruction science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, and presentation and discussion of 2021-22 Senate Bill 1882, Partnership Performance Outcomes. New Library Architecture on Agenda. During today's regularly scheduled Ector County Commissioners meeting, Ector County Library Director Howard Marks has a busy day with five items on the agenda. The biggest item is to consider, discuss, award, reject, or take any necessary action regarding specifications on a request for qualifications for architectural services for the building of the new library. This agenda item and others will be heard at 10 a.m. Tuesday at the Ector County Administration Building Annex located at Room 120 at 1010 East 8th Street in Odessa. It's a long time coming, Marks said over the phone on Monday morning. We are just excited about all of the possibilities for the community. This is really for them. This is literally going to be moving us into the future. It can fast-track us into 2030. On August 23rd, the Ector County Commissioner's Court unanimously approved using $250,000 in ARPA funds for architectural services for discovery, cost analysis, design, and construction of a new library. Odessa Arts Executive Director and Chair of the Ector County Library Committee, Randy Hamm, told commissioners during that meeting there are multiple firms that plan to bid on the project. Lucy Soto from the Ector County Purchasing Department and Marks are scheduled to give the presentation about the new architectural services. Marks said the current schedule is to officially start the bidding process and have that continue until November 21st. Mark said after that, a three-week evaluation process will take place and then hopefully make a decision about the new library before Christmas. The Ector County Library will also speak about action regarding the Memorandum of Understanding for a Friend of the Ector County Library grant for $25,000 for 2022-2023. Action regarding an agreement for Gale Cengage Excel Adult High School. Action regarding a 3-year annual license agreement for Beanstack Services. And action regarding a license agreement for News Bank Electronic Research Database Subscription. The court will also discuss the assistance and tools that are available to the Ector County Sheriff's Department and Odessa Police Department to combat the rise in drug-related crimes in Ector County. Consider, discuss, and take any necessary action regarding the contract proposal for Offenders Watch and authorize the county judge to sign. Consider, discuss, and take any necessary action to request 2 certified peace officer position statuses to be changed to service department. Consider, discuss, and take any necessary action to approve a request to hire a department coordinator at a Step 7 due to experience. Consider, discuss, and take any necessary action on Pentacourt, a subdivision of 5 acres in Section 25, Block 44, T2S, TNP, RICO Survey, Precinct 1, Ector County, Texas, and authorize the county judge to sign. Consider, discuss, and take any necessary action on a replat of the west 108 feet of Lot 6, Block 26, West Ridge Subdivision, second filing, being a replat of the 1.96 acres in Section 20, Block 23, T2S, TNP RR Co. Survey, Precinct 1, Ector County, Texas, and authorize the county judge to sign. Consider, discuss, and take any necessary action on a proposed MHRC development to serve 427 West 57th Street, 1.71-acre tract located in Lakeview Subdivision, Section 4, Lot 49, Block 42, Precinct 1, Ortega, Ector County, Texas, and authorize the county judge to sign. Review, consider, discuss, approve, and take any necessary action regarding the following proposed consent agenda. To consider, discuss, and approve a line item transfer on General Fund, Jail, Equipment, Maintenance, and Repair, 001420-5252 from Contract Services, 001420-5309 for $95,000. To consider, discuss, and approve a line item transfer to General Fund, Commissioners Precinct 4, Educational Travel, 001-024-5161 from Commissioner Precinct 1, Educational Travel, 001021-5161 for $710. consider and approve the accounts payable fund requirements report for October 11, 2022, to review county financial statements and reports. Council to hear compensation study. Odessa City Council members are expected to hear from the company hired to compare first responders' compensation packages with communities of like size tonight. Evergreen Solutions did not make any comparisons in a 9-page report released in advance of today's meeting. At today's meeting, they will discuss with the council pay philosophy, various options, and provide cost detail information related to each of the options, City Manager Mike Marrero said via email Monday evening. According to the report, city officials must decide what market position it wants to be in when compared to its peers, average 66th or 75th percentile, or at the top. The city must also decide if it wants to make changes to the total compensation or to the base pay. The city council must further decide how quickly it wants salaries to advance and how that should be done. Evergreen, which was paid $111,500 for the report, included the estimated populations and per capita income for 19 Texas cities and Ector County. The council voted unanimously July 26 to hire an outside firm to look at all the city employees' pay in comparison with other communities, but asked Evergreen Solutions to place a rush on first responders' pay because Odessa Fire Rescue is losing firefighters at a rapid rate, and some attribute it to poor pay. In fact, during the council meeting September 27th, Mayor Javier Hoven and council members Denise Warner and Mark Mata voted to give OFR raises before getting the results of the Evergreen study. The measure failed by a 4-3 vote. Swanner made a motion to raise new firefighters' starting salary by 22% to $65,823. To give captains a 15% raise, division captains a 12% increase, and battalion chiefs an 8% raise. The total cost could be covered by the city's American Rescue Plan Act money, she said. Upon hearing the first responders portion of the study was expected to be completed by today. The rest of the council voted against Swanner's motion. OFR Chief John Alvarez told the council 30 firefighters have left so far this year and 8 definitively attributed their departure to low pay. The council is also expected to consider entering a $0 lease agreement with the Black Cultural Council of Odessa for the Gertrude Bruce Historical Cultural Center, 1020 East Murphy Street. According to city documents, the Cultural Council would be solely responsible for the building's maintenance, repair, and operation expenses and would have to carry insurance. The council is also expected to deliberate the employment evaluation duties, discipline, complaint, or dismissal of the following people: Judge Carlos Rodriguez and Keith Kidd of Municipal Court, City Secretary Norma Aguilar Grimaldo, City Attorney Natasha Brooks, and City Manager Michael Marrero. The council has the option of holding the discussions in executive session. According to city officials, none of the above people received written evaluations as they are council appointees. Local news roundup: 2 in jail following theft accusations. 2 Odessa men are in the Ector County Jail after a local resident accused them of kicking in his door and stealing cash and an iPhone from him on August 27th. According to an Odessa Police Department report, an apartment dweller in the 600 block of Expressway told police he took his neighbor to an alley behind the 1200 block of East 42nd Street, but they left when a man in the alley demanded money for being in his alley. The man told police that 20 minutes later he heard a loud bang, and the man from the alley and Joel Jose Pineda, 48, came inside his apartment and demanded money from him. According to the report, when he refused to give them money, Christopher Aaron Galindo, 36, came into the apartment with his hand tucked into his pants and said if he didn't give them money, they'd kill him. The alleged victim, 48, gave the group roughly $180 and his Apple iPhone 13 Pro Max, valued at $1,100, the report stated. Security cameras caught the man from the alley and Penida attempting to kick in the alleged victim's door and all three men entering the apartment, according to the report. Penida was arrested October 2nd on suspicion of burglary of a habitation with the intention of committing another felony and is being held on a $70,000 surety bond. Galindo was arrested Sunday on an identical charge plus one count of failure to identify. He's also being held on surety bonds totaling $77,000. The name of the third man was redacted from the report, but he too is accused of burglary of a habitation with the intention of committing another felony, a first-degree felony punishable by 5 years to life in prison. Odessan arrested on drug charges. An officer sent to check on the welfare of a man outside of a local bar at 4 a.m. Saturday ended up seizing 42 grams of cocaine and making an arrest. According to an Odessa Police Department report, the officer dispatched to the Rocks on East University Boulevard found Sergio Castaneda Venegas, 34, asleep behind the wheel of his pickup truck. When the officer woke him up, Venegas leaned forward to get his cell phone, and the officer saw a clear bag containing multiple bags of a white powdery substance, the report stated. The officer weighed the substance he believed to be cocaine, and it weighed 42 grams, which is more than a user amount, the report stated. In addition, since the cocaine was also individually bagged, Venegas was arrested on suspicion of manufacture or delivery of a controlled substance, more than 4 grams, less than 200 grams. The drug charge is a first-degree felony punishable by 5 years to life in prison. Venegas remained in the Ector County Jail Monday on a $75,000 surety bond. Odessan accused of assault. An Odessa woman whose father took her to church Friday night so she could be prayed over ended up in jail after she allegedly attacked him and an Odessa Police Department officer. According to an OPD report, officers were dispatched to Odessa Christian Faith Center on Andrews Highway for a medical call about 5:40 p.m., and when they arrived, they found Davina Destiny Bajonda, 24, being held down on the floor. Bajonda's father told the officers he brought her to church to be prayed for, and during their prayers, she jumped up and attacked him, the report stated. He said he and the other church members placed her on the floor, held her down, and called 911. According to the report, an officer observed deep scratches on the father's right wrist and upper left forearm that was still bleeding. The officer also wrote in his report he saw Bajonda kick a fellow officer in the groin. Bajonda was arrested on suspicion of assault causing bodily injury, a misdemeanor, an assault on a public servant, a third-degree felony, punishable by 2 to 10 years in prison. Ector County jail records indicate Bajonda remained in custody Monday on surety bonds totaling $17,500. Odessan accused of aggravated assault. An Odessa man was arrested Friday on an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon charge after his girlfriend ended up in the hospital with a brain bleed, broken nose, and other injuries, according to an Odessa Police Department report. On September 27th, police officers were dispatched to Medical Center Hospital around 5 a.m. after an Odessa woman drove her 23-year-old daughter to the emergency room. The younger woman told officers she got into an argument with Gary Huff, 47, around 3 a.m. and it turned physical, the report indicated. The fight began in her vehicle and continued inside a home in the 1800 block of Boys Drive. The alleged victim told officers Huff used his fists and his feet to assault her head, face, and body, according to the report. She fled the residence and went home and told her mother, what had happened. Medical staff told officers the woman had a brain bleed, broken nose, and numerous bruises on her body, the report stated. A warrant was issued for Huff's arrest, and he was booked into the Ector County Jail Friday. He remained in the jail Monday on a surety bond of $75,000. Aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Family violence is a first-degree felony, punishable by 5 years to life in prison. Odessan arrested, gun seized. An Odessa man was arrested Saturday, 1 week after his girlfriend accused him of putting a gun to her head. According to an Odessa Police Department report, officers received a call about a man with a gun around 8:30 p.m. October 1st at an apartment on Hunter Miller Way. When officers arrived, they found Kenneth Pava, 30, in a hallway holding a gun in one hand and a woman by the arm in the other hand, the report stated. The woman, 27, told officers Pava grabbed her by the neck while they were arguing and also put the gun to her head, according to the report. Officers saw bruises, scratches, and red marks on her neck. Officers seized a 9mm Luger, the report stated. Pava was arrested on suspicion of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony, punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. He remained in the Ector County Jail Monday on a $50,000 surety bond. ECISD, report of kidnapping unfounded. Wednesday after school, Ector County ISD police got a call from a parent reporting an attempted kidnapping during after-school pickup at Jordan Elementary. The police and principal talked to a number of people on Thursday and Friday and believe a teacher confused two kindergarten boys for each other and stopped one of them from walking away with what she thought was the wrong person. It was the correct person and straightened out, a news release said. The social media post seemed to claim someone was trying to look like a mom and tried to take someone else's child, but nothing was found to support that, the release said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.